I, for one, welcome our new computer overlords. My PlayStation phone can make calls, and Verizon can't give away iPhones. All that and more on the Slongcast. And welcome to this episode of the Slongcast, episode number 24 for Tuesday, February 22nd, 2011. We have a full house, even fuller than normal because we have some remote people today. So let's start on the phone. We have Jim Jacoby. How's it going, Jim?
Doing well. How are you?
I could not be better. This is awesome. You're our initial or inaugural Skype caller. So how do you feel about that?
Oh, I'm honored. In this day and age of remote users, I'm surprised I'm the first on your show.
Yeah, that is true. It took me a while to get the wiring right, but you're here now. And in studio, to my right as usual, Mr. Ryan Lancey.
Hey, what's up?
And to my left, Mr. Matt Hunt.
Hey, how's it going?
I could be better if there wasn't snow. You know, the snow kind of killed me yesterday.
Yeah, that was a lot. There was green grass and some brown, and then now it's all white again.
Oh, it was horrible. Apparently, I drove by your house, though, so...
Actually, you got stuck by my house for 30 minutes.
Yeah, I got stuck by your house. Yeah. That was horrible. So why don't we get right in it? We got Jim on the line with us to start off with our first couple of stories, and that is about IBM Watson. So hopefully everybody who listens to the show saw the couple of episodes of Jeopardy, Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday last week, where IBM's supercomputer Watson took on Ken Jennings and who was it, Mark Rutter? Was that his name?
Rutter.
Yeah. Rutter.
Jeff Rutter.
Oh, yeah, Jeff Rutter. Whoops.
Whatever. So either way.
Brad Rutter. Wow, we're
third
terrible.
Third time's the charm.
Brad, it's Brad.
It's somebody Rutter. So either way.
Mr. X.
Mr. X. So Ken Jennings, IBM Watson, and Mr. X. And IBM's Watson pretty much crushed the human race, with a couple exceptions. So Jim, did you want to start us off with what you found interesting about this?
Well, I'll tell you why the computer won the show. And it's because it's very good at being a computer. And what people don't know about Jeopardy is that while you have to have the correct answer, most of the show is all in the timing of the buzzer. And after Alex Trebek reads a question, a human being actually presses another buzzer behind stage, signaling that he has finished the question, which tells the contestants, that lights up a light on their behind their podium, that they can now buzz in. And if they buzz in too soon, they actually get locked out for, I think it's a fifth of a second or something like that. But Watson's very good at being a computer, so as soon as the signal is being sent to him, and he has the confidence to trigger the buzz-in, he does it immediately.
So if you notice
on the show, the only time the other contestants could answer is either if Watson was wrong or didn't have the confidence to answer the question.
That is true. And one thing that I didn't notice until they showed it on one of the episodes was that Watson was physically pressing a button.
Yeah.
He wasn't solenoid. Just hardwired in.
Yeah. Well, I mean... The one point, you know, that I think that's critical there is that Watson had to have the right answer or a high confidence of the right answer. So it still had to, you know, I mean, if your brain worked that fast, you would buzz in earlier as well, I think, or at least time it.
No. I mean, I followed them pretty closely, and a lot of times I had the right answer halfway through Alex reading the question because I can read the screen.
Okay.
And I knew what the right answer is, but if I were a human contestant, I still had to wait for the light to come on and buzz in, or I had to anticipate and risk locking myself out. So I don't think time to recall is a big issue in Jeopardy play at that level. So it comes down a lot to the reaction time where the computer clearly beats the humans.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that would be a pretty big hole then.
Yeah. And what did you guys think of some of the funny answers that Watson gave? I remember one very clearly. It was in the decades category. And Ken Jennings answered, what is the 1920s? Alex is like, no. Watson answers, what is the 1920s? Alex is, no, Ken said that.
Yeah, so, well, we know Watson doesn't have any voice recognition. It's getting right, the questions by, you know, text message, basically.
Well, that was interesting, though, because that's a critical part of Jeopardy. At least for human contestants, if you're not sure of an answer, you can take what the other person said, knock out one of your answers, and then answer with the correct answer. You think they would have programmed something like that into Watson.
Well, right, and that's another thing I noted when I watched the show was that it's not very good at problem solving like human beings do, which is, I assume it was the same way for the schools you guys went to, but a lot of the time it was that you were taught to deduce the answer by looking at what are the wrong answers that are most obvious. And of course, the most obvious wrong answer is the guy that says the answer you were going to say and it was wrong.
Right.
But
yeah.
But then, like you said, though, it wasn't programmed for voice recognition.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice that they made to not do that, because I think most of us assumed before we saw Watson in actually on the show that it would be doing voice recognition. We didn't realize that.
I thought that as well.
Yeah, but one of the findings from the program was that there was one category for the second round, the final round, where the clues were all very short. It was the one about the directors, and they listed two movies or something like that.
Right.
And the clues were very short, and it didn't take Alex very long to read those. And one of the results was that Watson had trouble with that because it didn't have enough processing time before Alex was done. So I think Watson needed the advantage of getting the textual representation of the question instantly. And I think if it had to do voice recognition, it might have gotten beaten pretty bad.
Yeah, that is true. At least in that category, I don't think he got a single one, did he? Or maybe he only got one. Like, he pretty much got beaten on that category.
Well, I mean, humans clearly have an advantage, I think, because they have to hear the question, or they can hear the question and read it, where Watson only can read it. So a lot of these arguments, Watson may have an advantage in such and such, he clearly has a disadvantage in the fact that he can't take into account intonation, the sound of Alex's voice, and other things of that nature.
Yeah,
that's right. And that's the thing I think computers will probably never be able to do is take basically not, they're not riddles, but they kind of are, or take allegory into context. It's just the human language. Even you get someone from California that comes to Western Pennsylvania, and they have no idea what we're talking about.
Yeah, that is true. We do have some weird words.
Gob.
Yeah, and that's everywhere. That's every sub region of the country. It's not even the north or the south. It's just the human language is so complex that I just don't. And the way our language operates, you can give a computer raw information. It can, for the most part, try to spew out the right answer at you, but
You bring up
artificial
a pretty good.
Artificial intelligence is a stretch, I would say.
You bring up a maybe a side point there. I think Jim is like, I wonder if Watson were programmed to think in another human language other than English, like maybe saying something of Asian descent or African. Is there another language that computers would be better at because there's less of that, all these like riddles and different parts of speech that English has that's a little bit unique.
I think it might be safe.
I definitely think it wouldn't be an Asian language, because I think that the Asian languages are probably the most complex on the face of the earth.
Yeah, that could be. I don't know. I'm just saying, is there something?
I think it might be safe to say that at least most other language. I mean, English is a pretty rough language just because we have so many words for every, a different word for every tense, for every everything. Whereas a lot of other languages, take Spanish, for example. It's one word and you just conjugate a couple letters change depending on what you mean. So it might have actually been easier to program Watson for some other languages.
Speaking of languages, Watson's already mastered the universal language, which is mathematics. Computers have mastered that for decades now. And that's, that's how computers are designed, is mathematics.
Yeah, and while you bring that up, let's move on to our second article, which was actually an interview. I don't know if it was an interview or an article actually written by Ken Jennings, but one thing that he brought up was not just about Watson on Jeopardy, but about what this means for us in general outside of Jeopardy. What can Watson do other than answer trivia questions? Matt, what do you think in terms of what can we put Watson to use for that would be better than just answering trivia.
Well, one thing they kept bringing up on the promo bits during the show was things like analyzing medical records, which are written in natural language. Although, you know, medical language has a structure to it and you know, a vocabulary to it that constrains it a little. So that may be a strength where it could mine electronic patient records and try to find, you know, correlations between symptoms and diagnoses or diagnoses and treatments and outcomes that could be beneficial just on the basis of the sheer volume of records that would be available to it in natural language.
In addition to correlations, just missing things a human might not see. Like, you know, I mean, maybe, I don't know how common it is, but you always see on the shows, it's on doctor, you know, medical shows, it's like, oh, well, didn't you see that they should have this thing because of the symptoms they had? And if these things were just routinely put into a computer that sort of double checked the doctor in the sense that not to undermine the doctor's authority, but just to catch things that they may not have thought of.
Yeah, things like drug interactions, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, it definitely would be a good safety net for those things. Was just mentioned, drug interactions, because there's any number of drugs on the market that can interact with each other. And if there's known interactions that someone may never have heard of, that's a good catch.
Yeah, do you see anything, Jim? Can you think of any place other than the medical field that maybe Watson would be really good for?
Yeah, the intelligence community.
That is very true.
I mean, the government could definitely use. I'm sure they already have it, but they could definitely use something like that. I mean, just the mountains of data that are being shuffled from agency to agency. Yeah, why not centralize it?
Well, that would require agencies to work together, Jim.
Yeah, since 2001, we have, right?
Of course we have.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, I mean... Anything
that you can just put plain text, mountains of information, and it would take a human being more time than it's worth to mine it, you could apply this to. I mean, you could actually have a Wikipedia that could regulate itself.
Yeah, and at the rate of Moore's Law, you know, what one of IBM Watson's engineers said, you know, pretty soon we'll have a Watson on our watch, you know, or I think as Ryan said, what did you call it, Watchson? Was that you who coined
I don't know that was mine. It might have been somebody else.
Somebody coined Watchson.
Watchson.
But, yeah, I mean, in a couple of years, you know, everybody might be able to have, not everybody, but, you know, hospitals might be able to have this technology in something smaller than an entire server room. And,
you know, another thing that it may be useful for, and I didn't think of this until this afternoon. I was doing a little more research on it. Sports betting.
Sports betting.
Or you know, like the rank. You know how they had that weird ranking system for college football?
Yes, I do.
Okay. Did you happen to notice when Watson would get the daily double and he would bet an odd amount?
Yeah, $1,947, Alex.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's a reason for that. There was actually I think it's called like a regression algorithm or something. He would base its wagers on the daily doubles based on the confidence it had in the answer itself. You know, without even knowing what it was, just.
That's interesting.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we've seen this sort of thing used in a similar manner with the micropayments. What do they call that? With the transactions on Wall Street. They're doing these
high frequency trading.
Yeah. There's these massive computers that, you know, are analyzing the markets constantly and finding the best way to trade. And I think, you know, that's something that could definitely be applied to.
Yeah. Wagers. Some of those are based on news stories and rumors and forum posts and all that crap. So
yeah,
that's definitely the kind of thing it could be applied to.
Yeah, I mean, I personally see this being used once it gets smaller in footprint in almost every walk of life. I mean, really, there are things that we do every day where we're comparing lots of things. I mean, just think of, you know, buying a baby stroller. You know, imagine if you could just say, hey, Watson, what's the best baby stroller? It combs through thousands of things and says, oh, yeah, it's this one.
Well, and with its strength in natural language processing, it can deal with the Amazon reviews and all that stuff.
Exactly.
That are hard, you know, in terms of the text content of them.
That's an interesting question, though. We just using the same question you asked. What's the best baby stroller? Well, what defines best?
Yeah, I mean that's where, I mean, even humans knowing the different versions of best and what they could possibly mean in relation to a baby stroller, there are several answers, and none of them really are the right answer.
That's true, but at least with Watson, you can get an answer that gives you, maybe say Watson can give you a list of all of the baby strollers that have the lowest return rate, you know, the cheapest price. Like, they can comb through
That's pretty easy right now. I think where you get the benefit is if you tell Watson what matters to you, right? That
give it a list of things.
You know, I live in a rural area and it needs to work on a gravel driveway or something like that, because then it can process the textual content of the reviews and figure out what the strollers excel at and what they're bad at, more than just using the price and the number of stars and other quantitative metrics.
Yeah, that's I'm looking forward to it.
I don't think it could process open-ended questions like what's the best. Well, everyone has a different criteria for what's the best in any given thing.
Yeah, for some people, it's the prettiest. What's the prettiest?
Yeah,
it's pink. It's beautiful.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
It's just like that commercial on TV. I'm looking for a new car. Is it blue? Because I think you should get the blue one.
Exactly.
So, Gemma, did you have any other thoughts about Watson? Anything you wanted to bring up?
I only wrote down one other thing, and I think that was Matt that touched on earlier, was when he was mentioning being able to know the answer to the question before it was completed. And I wonder how Watson would compete in my high school, we called it Scholastic Quiz, but I think most schools call it like a Quiz Bowl.
Quiz Bowl, yeah.
Where as soon as the host starts reading the question, you can ring in for the answer. How do you think Watson would compete in something like that, where the human found the key word in the question before the question was finished and the computer could process it?
Yeah, I don't think it would be that good, just because of, I don't know if it was an article or on the TV show, they said about, what was it, the 3-second processing time?
Yeah, I've looked for information substantiating that, and I haven't found anything that says that it needs absolutely 3 seconds.
I think at times on TV you could see it regenerating its list of answers as if
I did
it,
see that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So
the list changed.
It's working progressively. One thing in a well-written quiz bowl question is that it will build information, right? So it starts with the most general and builds to more specific, and there's an advantage to buzzing in earlier if you can get it with less information. So I guess the question is whether Watson could take advantage of that. Like, I know whenever a question began, you know, this Danish physicist, you buzzed in and said Niels Bohr, because if it was a Danish physicist, it was always Niels Bohr.
Yeah, it's like, oh, name a country that starts with D, then
Denmark.
Go up one letter, and or yeah, that whole thing. And like, it's like, what animal starts with the letter after D? An elephant. You know, it's always the same thing. Yeah, although it could be elk, I guess.
It could be elk.
Yeah,
got to watch out for those elks.
You know, just one final thought on that too. I was wondering, like, I thought at one time with Jeopardy, You could buzz in before the question, like way back.
I remember that. I remember Alex getting cut off a lot of times.
Yeah, like way back. So like, this seems to me like it's a new rule, like recent. I don't remember that from when I was a kid.
Yeah, I haven't watched Jeopardy much recently at all, so I don't know when this started happening.
Yeah, I used to watch it all the time religiously when I was in high school and earlier, and now I probably haven't seen, this is the first time I've watched it in a while.
Yeah, I don't remember that happening. I can usually read the questions about half the time Alex takes to read it out loud.
Yeah.
So I could see him never getting to finish anything.
Yeah, if they would have allowed that. Oh, well.
The only reason I know that is because I usually when they – I don't know if you guys know this or not, but Jeopardy has online tryouts that you can take the test online, and if you score well enough, they'll invite you to do a live tryout for the show. And I've been doing those, and I've been reading the rules you know, they explain like how the show works, and you know, okay, you go out there, you're going to be compared to like you're with three contestants that scored similarly to you, because they want to have a competitive game. They don't want to have, you know, a blowout. They try to prevent that, even though some guys like Ken Jennings go on there and blow everyone out of the water.
Yeah.
But that the only reason I know that is because it was on their website, and I happened to look into it after I was talking to Kevin last week about the Jeopardy show.
Oh, okay.
With Watson.
Yeah, so you heard it here first, folks. Jim Jacoby will soon be on Jeopardy once he masters the online version.
Hey, those questions are hard, and it's not likely that I'll be on there anytime soon. Because I'm particularly bad at English literature.
As am I.
I just like saying the word literature. I sound so educated.
It's almost like pentalobular.
Ooh, pentalobular.
Ooh, that's
I got a drink. I think I added that to the drinking game last week.
Oh,
drink.
Pentalobular literature.
I'm going to have a potent potable right now.
Ooh. I'll take anal bum cover for 400, Alex.
S words for 500.
You know, that's a real shame they didn't make Watson's voice in Sean Connery's.
Oh, that would have been great.
What an opportunity they had there.
You know, the old service Tell Me, it was kind of like Google 411. Actually, it became Bing's telephone service.
Oh, okay.
But you called 1-800... 411 Tell or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
555 Tell, I think it was. And one of the services on that telephone service was a blackjack game. And the blackjack game had a computer voice impersonating Sean Connery.
Oh.
Nice.
That is awesome. Well, Jim, thank you very much for coming on and sharing your thoughts about Watson.
Thanks for having me. We'll have to do it again sometime.
We will. Have a good night.
You too. Take care, guys.
All right, so let's move on to our next group of stories. And we talked a while about the group Anonymous. We talked a while ago about the group Anonymous. And we have a couple articles here to talk about some things. The first one being the Stuxnet worm. So we talked about the Stuxnet worm, the CIA spy virus that took over Iran's nuclear plants and basically made them non-functional. But apparently,
it was Mossad.
What's that?
I thought it was Mossad.
People come out and say it is, but you know, we know better. I mean, come on.
Okay. This is the Sloncast investigative journalism.
Yes. Okay. I did so much work on this. But apparently Anonymous has the Stuxnet worm, and they released a decompiled version online. So personally, I see this as being very bad, because that worm wasn't really out in the public, at least a code version that people could see. But now that this is out there, I mean, this opens up the doors for all of the bad guys out there to see a virus that can hide itself, can evade security systems. You know, what do you guys think about this being out in the open?
Well, I mean, it's definitely going to shorten the time span in which it's required to repackage the virus and use it in another fashion. If somebody would want to do that, there's even with the machine code or whatever of it, somebody could figure out what it does, but the source code makes that all that much easier.
Yeah. And just that, you know, this is such a high quality virus, you know, like it can infiltrate systems that aren't on a network. Like, can you imagine how long it took somebody to write code to test for all the possible, you know, ways to get in? Like, that's ridiculous.
Yeah, I'm really scared for the continued safe operation of my uranium centrifuge.
I know, right? You should be scared.
Oh, I thought we already had Stuxnet by now. I thought it was that pervasive that we all had a copy and didn't know it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Are you joking about that, or are you?
I'm half joking. I mean, that was the point, right? Was that it would spread to all sorts of computers, but it would only be active in the target computers.
Yeah, because it started being picked up for years before people found out what it did, because it never did anything, because it never found the correct Siemens controller.
Well, I mean, there's definitely other viruses out there that do worry me. That, and like Storm is one of them. It's like a botnet virus, but I thought Stuxnet only lived jumping through like thumb drives. I thought that was how it worked.
Well, that's how they got it from internet connected computers to Iran's centrifuge computers, because they're not on the internet.
Yeah, I had assumed it would propagate on a closed network, but
It does.
Okay, I'm wrong.
So they just did the thumb drive way to get it across that disconnected barrier.
Across the air gap.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a better term than what I just said. What I said made no sense.
I mean, what I wonder is, like, I mean, if you have an antivirus program, is it going to find Stuxnet, or is it that clouded or shrouded.
Well, supposedly it did because, you know, who was it? Was it Trend Micro? One of the antivirus companies detected it a year before we heard anything about Iran getting hit with it.
Okay.
So it was being detected and people were looking at it going, this doesn't look like a virus to me. I don't know what it does. It's not hurting anybody. Why is it out there?
Yeah.
Yeah, so it was being detected by, you know, personal antiviruses and such, and it was on people's computers. It just wasn't hurting anything.
Right, like a benign tumor.
Yeah, because nobody was running a yellow cake uranium centrifuge.
Running at exactly the right rotational speed.
Exactly, and the exact Siemens controller board and
the
whatever.
The proper protocol and yada,
whatever. Mm. So that's bad. I think we all agree that being out there is bad, Stuxnet. But let's keep going with Anonymous in that we also talked about them hacking HB Gary Federal, the one company that was trying to help the FBI figure out who the senior Anonymous members were. And this one article from Ars Technica, this brings up two big things, but I'll just explain the article first. And the article goes into how Anonymous hacked HB Gary Federal. Very, very detailed. SQL injections, emails back and forth. So basically, they used SQL injection, they infiltrated the server, they got access to email accounts. They used, HB Gary Federal uses Google for their company's email accounts, and they got the CEO's account, but the CEO's account also happened to be the owner of the Google Services account. So by having that account, they now had access to everybody's. So they used that to do some social engineering, pretend they were this one guy asking one of their admins, hey, I need root access to do this thing. Can you give me, you know, the account? Can you tell me? Oh, I forget the IP address. Can you tell me? Oh, I forget my username. Is it this? No. And the guy just went along with it because, I mean, it was coming from the correct email address. You know, it looked like real email. But everybody kind of thought that the anonymous attacks were some super high-tech things, but it was standard attacks. It was SQL injection. It was social engineering. And they got right in. But the one point that I wanted to bring up with this, and then you guys can, you know, go off on that, is that this writer from Ars Technica seems to have an inside track with somebody in Anonymous. That's the only way he gets this information.
I noticed that from the article. Yeah. I mean, it seems, it's like, oh, yeah, I talked to Anonymous.
Exactly.
Blah, blah, blah.
The dude says in, like, paragraph 2, I spoke to Anonymous.
Yeah.
Really?
I mean, I don't know. What are the ethical standards in journalism with respect to, you know, speaking to members of like
terrorist organizations?
Yeah, is there any, and not divulging, like, when just knowing the identity of the person would, like, basically, like, unravel the entire organization? Is there any journalistic, like, integrity there? Like,
I think if you get news, you publish it.
Well, right.
I mean, going back to Deep Throat and the Pentagon Papers and stuff, you know, you protect the confidentiality of your sources if you believe the information is newsworthy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe just split your question into two and let's take the first half. You know, are there any ethics in journalism? No.
Wow.
So let's just start there. I mean, I think that's especially the case in stories of this caliber. You know, something that takes on an entire government. I think everybody's going to post everything they have.
Well, I understand that they're going to post it. I don't know. I guess we haven't had a lot of experience with this lately where people have an inside, like, no one has an inside track on, like, Osama bin Laden right now.
That's true. This, you know, is the first of those cases.
Right, and I think if somebody, like, had, you know, and they wouldn't divulge where he was, it'd be an interesting, like, I don't know, just moral dilemma, I guess. Not that, I mean, maybe he's not even the worst, but, you know.
No, I get your point, yeah.
You know, I'm not faulting these guys for not, it's just, that struck me as weird. It's like, hey, he knows who Anonymous is. That's a big deal.
Right.
Well, he knows who a guy in Anonymous is.
Right, well,
a guy who probably wanted his story published in Ars Technica for the lulz.
For the lulz. Well, yeah, and then you bring up a good point. A guy, it doesn't even, you know, I'm sure the organization is structured such that just because you know it's this guy, that it doesn't, you know, you don't know the whole organization. It's kind of like the mafia.
I'm not convinced that the organization is structured.
Yeah. And that's what Anonymous has kept saying. They're like, you guys think you know our senior officials. We don't have senior officials. You know, that's what they keep saying.
Well,
like, we're
not
structured like you think we're structured.
But that's what the mafia said for, you know, 50 years. until they brought down the Gambino family.
Yeah, there's always one person at the top.
Right.
But yeah, in the article, it's paragraph 3. The guy says, I've talked to some of those, who participated in the H.B. Gary hack. So obviously he spoke to more than one person from Anonymous who was in this hack. And if it's anything to go off of previous stories, the ones where H.B. Gary Federal thought they knew senior officials, some of them were in California, some of them were in New York. So, you know, in terms of your comparison of like bin Laden, it's probably much easier to talk to Anonymous because a lot of them are in the United States. And, you know, like they said, some people in Anonymous are random IT workers who do this when they go home. Or they might be a doctor who just likes what they're doing and, hey, I'll help out. Give me your software. I'll install it. You can control my machine. You know, so
I mean, these people are obviously, though, I mean, they do know that they're like enemies of the state at this point. I mean,
Do they know that?
That may not fully sink in.
Yeah.
I mean, they may be young enough to not realize what they're doing, but I think as you get older, you gain a seriousness about computer cracking, and I'll use the word cracking because I really don't like the misuse of hacking, but breaking and entering a computer system is no different than breaking and entering a home, regardless of how you do it.
Yeah, I don't think the full implications of that hit a lot of 16-year-olds who right. may, in fact, have the technical skills to participate in this.
I don't think it hits the fools of like 23 or 24-year-olds. Yeah, you know, sure. There's a threshold, I think, in your mid-20s where you start to learn that sort of, like, not responsibility, but just... Yeah, that's responsibility, I guess.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or you hit that threshold a lot earlier if you're thrown in jail when you're 18 for participating in one of these things.
You know, the interesting point is that maybe, you have to wonder, maybe this is what the mafia has got into. You know, the modern mafia may have realized that they're better off dealing in, you know, the electronic realm.
I'm sure the Russian mafia has.
Yeah. I mean, mm-hmm. that's for sure.
All of those middle European countries.
Yeah.
Where all
I mean, I'm not trying to
from.
Say, oh, there's no one in the United States that's doing this, but it's interesting that this is maybe the new organized crime. I mean, that's essentially what they are, is an organized crime syndicate.
Definitely. And, you know, they're big. And when you get big, you know, coming into our next article, you get people trying to copy you and pretend to be you. So I'm sure... Anybody who has a television has heard of the Westboro Baptist Church. They're the people who protest the funerals of our military members, and they do other bad things. Well, they pretended to be Anonymous, sending out press releases, telling people to do things, and Anonymous had to come out and say, whoa, guys, all of you who actually aren't Anonymous, don't do anything. This is a trap. There are people out there sniffing for your IP addresses. Don't DDoS anybody. Don't hack anybody because they're going to get you.
This seems a little unrealistic to me. So, like, and here's why. So, in the first article, we have Anonymous going after H.B. Gary Federal, right? And they get in and they blow up their computer system, and they're not worried about like anyone tracking their IPs. But now they're worried about it. Like, come on. This doesn't make any sense to me.
Well, here's one way I can see that, is that the people who did the H.B. Gary hacking might have been smarter members of Anonymous or more senior members that knew what they were doing, whereas when this press release came out, quote-unquote, from Anonymous saying, hey, go DDoS these people, that would have attracted all of the junior Anonymous people who might not know what they're doing.
Yeah, I agree with Kevin, because if you remember after the WikiLeaks thing, the... Anonymous went after the credit card issuers and so forth.
Yeah,
and
Visa, MasterCard.
Yeah, that was a DDoS thing and required a vast army of Anonymous. And some of those people ended up getting in trouble because their IPs could be traced. So I think there is a difference between the hordes who do these DDoS attacks getting their IPs traced because they're not very sophisticated versus the very targeted surgical, you know, exploit driven attacks that we saw in the H.B. Gary case.
Right, yeah. But I mean, why? I'll concede that point. I just think that it's like maybe they really aren't. Then maybe they aren't as organized as we think they may be. Or
I don't think they're organized.
Yeah.
And it's funny because,
it's basically just, do harm on the internet and then credit with Anonymous.
Well, I think there's some degree of organization. Like if you want to attack RIAA, every 14-year-old on the internet hates the RIAA, right? Because they prosecute people for tens of thousands of dollars because they BitTorrented an album.
Yeah.
Right? So everybody hates those, and they're an easy target to attack. But when you get into the political issues that are maybe a little more complicated, I can imagine that some people who participated in the RIAA attacks agree with the position of anonymous. Mm-hmm. I'm using air quotes, which you can't see on the podcast. whereas other members who might have been all for attacking the RIAA see things from a different point of view and don't participate. So I think the degree of organization probably just depends on the popularity of the position.
Yeah, that's true.
Very interesting.
Matt's so smart. Why don't we have him on more often?
I know, right? We should totally like have him on next week.
Yeah.
Hint, hint. So let's move on. And let's say, what if you guys were going and applying for a new job? Would you give up your Facebook login so that your potential future employer could log into your account and see what you have been doing? Ryan, what do you say?
Well, the first thing I would do is probably create a dummy account and give them the W account password.
And then make a lot of posts. Oh, I love this company. They're so nice.
I just found out about Facebook last Thursday.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. If this article isn't a reason for having a second Facebook account that you kind of use for like just certain things, then I don't know what is.
I got to set up a Friendster account just for this purpose.
Oh, there
like,
you go.
Like, I don't do this Facebook thing, but...
I'll give him my MySpace password.
Yeah, so the article is from The Atlantic, and the Maryland Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services, this one guy was applying for a job to be a corrections officer, and they basically said, give us your Facebook login, or you don't get the job.
Did I mention no?
Exactly.
Yeah.
This is no different to me than giving someone your bank account. Like, you may consider your money valuable or your friends and your online content valuable. Either way, no one has any right to access it other than you.
However, that is a good point, because as I was listening to this week's Twit, Tom Mara was saying that in California, whenever companies do, you know, background checks on you, you do have to give them your bank number. You don't have to give them anything else, but you have to give them your number. So in some parts of the country, you do have to give them that stuff.
I think Tom Merritt is sadly mistaken on that. Basically, a company is allowed to use a third-party service that would check your credit records to see that if you're delinquent on accounts, but in no case do you have to give anyone your bank account number.
Yeah, Ryan's comments are consistent with my experience in California as of, you know, 4 or 5 years ago.
Yeah, because first of all, privacy issues aside, the content that you put online anywhere online is your copyright. You own the copyright unless you sign some agreement that says you give up exclusive property of it, which you don't give up exclusive rights to anything on Facebook. You grant Facebook a non-exclusive license to reuse your content. That's what you do. I mean, I guess a company could force you to sign a similar agreement that you give them a non-exclusive license to use your content. But if any company would do that, I would totally flat out refuse to do it. And I think the ACLU is, I mean, not always correct in all the things they prosecute, but this is something that I definitely would support them in.
Yeah. To go with what Ryan said, aside from those issues, I think it's stupid from a couple of perspectives on the hiring company's side. For one thing, we in IT tell people frequently, you don't give your password up to anyone, right? If you call the help desk or whatever and you're having a problem, you can't log in, whatever, they're not going to ask you for your password. If you need your password reset, they'll reset it to something new. They never need to know your old password. So one thing we try to drill into people is you never tell somebody your password. And mm-hmm. Why would I hire somebody who during an interview told me their password? That indicates poor security practices in the first place. Another thing that I thought about is you're hiring someone. You get their Facebook login. You have access to all their private communication. In reviewing that, you find out what health problems you have. You find out that, oh, she's trying to have children and maybe she'll be pregnant soon. You find out all of these things that if you decide for whatever reason not to hire this candidate turn into a huge discrimination liability against you.
Yeah.
Why would you willingly expose yourself to all of a candidate's private information when you're in the hiring process?
And they must have thought that because this article was put out on February 19th, and there is an update to the article on February 22nd that the Maryland Department of Public Safety and Correctional Services has suspended this practice.
I'm glad they have, because I was going to say, while I know President Obama has changed this policy in the United States, I think this would be most appropriate for a don't ask, don't tell policy when it comes to the passwords to your personal accounts.
And let's take this one step further. So companies may not ask you for your Facebook login, but they still want that information. So companies will check up on people on Facebook. And some people like me, all their information is public, they can get everything. But those people who have everything private, they can't. So wouldn't it be better for them, maybe not better for them, but could you see this happening where companies are like, oh, hey, you know, come into our office. Hey, friend us on Facebook. You know, you're applying for a job. They friend the company on Facebook, and now that company has access to their information. Not all of their private communications, because they can't see their messages, but now they can see all the stuff that they couldn't before because they're a friend.
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't surprise me at all. I think that's a pretty routine practice, I would speculate. Maybe not even the active part of asking people to become their friend, but the sort of cyber-stalking thing where you look someone up on Facebook or Twitter or their blogs or whatever, and you see what they posted in public. And at least for some positions, what a person expresses in public, I think, is germane to the hiring process. My thinking is if people say something in public, then, you know, take that into account.
Especially if you are looking to be hired for a PR position.
Sure.
Somebody where you will be in the public for your job. They would want to know that stuff.
Yeah, or if you're going to be responsible for, you know, large amounts of money or, you know, government secrets or anything like that.
Right.
How you comport yourself in public may be relevant to that process.
Very true. So let's move on. Our next article, Ryan, you might be more interested in this than anybody else, is that Google Chrome may no longer have a visible address bar. Do you see this happening?
Well, I'd welcome it. I love the minimalist browser style that Chrome offers. In the article, they go over four different layouts that they propose that might, you know, become popular along with their classic layout. They have a compact layout where the URL bar is removed and part of the tab. And then also another layout where the tabs are on a sidebar, and then some other layout for touchscreens. I actually most like and are most interested in the side tab view, because for a long time I've been saying that, you know, while, yeah, widescreens are cool for TV, for computing it doesn't make a lot of sense because pages are typically taller than they are wide. Mm-hmm. And content doesn't spread across the screen as well in most browsers and the way web pages are designed. It just, we've been in an 8x11 world for years, and I think I'd rather see more of the content in its natural format.
I have 2 points to that. The first one is just my personal view, and that's anybody who maximizes a browser on a widescreen monitor should be punched in the throat.
Well, I'd never do that.
I know. So my other point is, do we really need more vertical real estate? I mean, seriously, are we that thirsty for pixels that we need Google to remove 20 pixels so that we can get one more line of text on the screen? Do we really need this compact of an interface?
Absolutely.
Why? I have no need for this.
Because the screens that they've given us on computing systems are wider than they are tall.
But they didn't shrink. The resolution didn't get any shorter.
Show me. The average laptop today sold has no more than 900 pixels of resolution vertically. And before that, with 4x3 screens, it was commonplace to find a 1280 by 1024 screen.
So we went from 1024 to my Mac, which is 960. Big deal.
900, 1440 by 900.
Okay, whatever.
Yeah.
I do not notice a difference.
The 100 and some pixels of difference makes.
But what does that equal? 3 lines of 10-point font?
Yeah, but my 10-inch netbook is, what, 600 pixels vertically?
Yeah.
Something
okay,
like that.
So in that
so,
market.
So on that market, I can understand it. On a regular laptop, 900 pixels, yeah, I can sort of see it. On my desktop, which is what I use most of the time. No, I don't care so much. But yeah, I think it depends on what kind of monitor or screen you're using.
I mean, even on my screen, it's 1920 by 1080. So it's technically larger than a 1280 by 1024 screen. I still find that many pages on the web have so many ads at the top of the screen that the content is several pages down. I would love to see more, vertical real estate. I mean, maybe advertisers would just take advantage of it horizontally then, and it would make the problem even worse. But
and now a message from our sponsor, AdBlock Plus, helping Ryan view the internet. No, we don't have a sponsor.
Yeah, I mean, ads are something that I'm willing to put up with, but you know, if I can see my content and the ads, I would like that better than just the ads.
I will agree with that, most definitely. I hope that, well, I don't use Google Chrome, so I don't care what they do, but I would hope for everybody else's sake that they give you the option. In the next version, they don't just take away the URL bar or hide it under a tab and give you no other option for any other layout. You know, it would be nice to have a choice. But Google seems to just do what they think is best all the time. So I guess we'll see. Did they say when the next version?
Well, I mean, it's been like every 6 months. You know, 9 came out. I'm imagining 10 will be out sometime late summer.
Well, I mean, did they specifically say when this navigation change would go into effect? Would it be the next version? Would it be two versions from now? I don't recall seeing that.
I don't know.
Yeah, so, well, if you use Chrome, you might see that soon where the URL bar just disappears and you have to figure out where it's at. So have fun with that. Of course, that's just my opinion. Ryan wants to punch me now because I always hate on Chrome.
I mean, well, I don't know if you remember the full screen view for IE, like way back, like they had that
I do, yeah, F11.
Yeah, I mean, it's sometimes it's compelling for certain websites. I mean, no one designs for it anymore, but, you know, when you have a website that fully takes advantage of your screen, it's interesting.
That is true. So a topic we haven't talked about for a while, net neutrality. And by a while, I mean maybe like a week and a half, 2 weeks. Pretty sure we talked about it on the last show. I don't know. But apparently, a lot of people in the House of Representatives, do not like net neutrality. So much so that they just passed an amendment to block funds to support it, to support what the FCC passed in December. Really? Matt, do you have any thoughts on this?
I didn't know we needed funds to support net neutrality. How much does that cost?
Yeah, that would be interesting if the article said that.
Well, I mean, this has been a longstanding theme of the Republican Party as they've been elected, is that, oh, we'll just defund the things.
All of which comes from the federal discretionary funding, which is, what, 12% of the budget,
yeah.
Something like that.
We'll save money by defunding the things, I mean, that have been put in place. I don't think it really matters. If you're looking at a purely ideological world, I think part of what many Republicans that actually know what net neutrality is about dislike about it is that there's already laws on the books to sort of prevent it. In terms of like antitrust and monopoly and other things.
A common carrier.
Yeah. I mean, I would hope that they just enforce the freaking laws that are on the books, because that would probably protect 90% of the cases and this wouldn't be a problem at all.
And here's one of the reasons they gave as to why they are blocking funds for net neutrality. They argue that it will stifle innovation and investment in broadband. Is that funny to any of you guys? Because that's the exact reason that everybody gives for net neutrality.
I would like to have broadband.
That
is my position.
That's yes, a good point.
Matt's in a location in Pennsylvania that's so like well-situated, close to everything other else except broadband.
The new national broadband map, which I don't think made our topic list, indicated 5 sources of broadband available in my area. The actual number is 0.
Yeah.
Really?
I don't know if anyone's checked that nationalbroadband.gov out, whatever it's called. It's the website is completely flawed. The thing that worries me the most, and this is one of the reasons, and I'm not trying to get all political, it's one of the reasons I don't like big government organizations. They're going to make this thing the source for information. It's going to be the like central thing, like, oh, here's how you find out where you get broadband. I don't know how the carriers are getting away with it, but they're obviously lying or just stupid about the the actual coverage of their system. Like, they have Fios available in Ebensburg and Johnstown, which I know, in fact, it's not available.
I thought it was available in Ebensburg.
It will be extremely soon in Ebensburg.
Well, that's good to know, I guess.
In my area, they draw a geographic area, you know, bounded by a few roads. The roads are bigger than the road I live on. You know, only a couple of miles in extent. And it lists Comcast and Atlantic Broadband, which are the cable carriers. It lists the Connex, who does the Cambria Connected fixed wireless, which can't reach my house due to line of sight.
Oh.
It lists Verizon, which is the phone company, and DSL. And there's one more. I know there were five. But none of them reach my house, which is sort of in the middle of this geographic area, bounded by these larger roads. On the other hand, I was able, through the national broadband map, to designate my house as a dead zone. I could say that, no, none of these five carriers that you think serve my house serve my house.
Well, that's cool. I didn't know that.
So maybe that will get somewhere. You know,
that's cool.
And if there's funding related to this to bring service to those who are underserved, maybe that'll make a difference. In a year or 3 years, maybe we'll know.
Yeah, if we can use the website as a voice for, hey, I don't have it, then that's great. I didn't know that. That's really cool.
Under each of the five choices, I could say yes or no, this company serves my house, and I could mark no for all of those. And then there's a separate option to designate your house as a dead zone where there's no broadband service whatsoever, and I was able to do that. So we'll see where that goes.
Yeah, hopefully somewhere. I just looked up the county that I live in. It says 98% of people in this county have access to at least 4 megabits broadband.
Well, I'm in the same county, and I think there's more than 2% of us, but we'll see.
Yeah, we'll see how well they pay attention to what people submit on that site.
Yeah, I'm curious to see. It could go well, or it could just be a big waste of money. We'll see.
I'm going to go for the latter. It's probably a waste of money. So our next article, Matt, I believe you submitted.
Wow, how about that? I didn't even know I'd be here today. this was a story I think we've discussed before, the ability of the U.S. government to seize domain names without any particular due process.
Right.
They think somebody's trafficking in counterfeit goods or trademark infringement or child pornography, and they can seize the domain name from the registrar, point that domain name to basically a site with a big federal badge and some seriously worded messages and keep people from getting to the website. And the U.S. government did this. They seized, I think it was like a domain registrar or reseller or a dynamic DNS, something like that.
It was it belongs to free DNS.
So a dynamic DNS, which had the implication of taking 84,000 websites offline and replacing those websites without any due process with a federal badge and a warning about the severe implications of child pornography, as if everybody using those 84,000 websites was in fact trafficking in child porn. This was a mistake.
Yes.
Well, I mean, basically what the federal government engaged in was basically slander.
I would agree with that.
Maybe libel. I'm not sure the exact definition, but or defamation.
I mean, they didn't explicitly say this website was engaged in child pornography. They posted a badge and a statement of how much trouble you can be in if you engage in child pornography.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's completely unacceptable regardless of the intent. Like, while, you know, there's part of prosecution or whenever you're trying to find somebody guilty of a crime, they need a mens rea, which is like basically, I meant to do it.
I knew it was wrong and I did it anyway.
Exactly. And they may not have had that. The government didn't have the mens rea in the sense that, we took down these websites on purpose and we knew that we were doing it wrong. Nonetheless, they've could have inflicted terrible damage on these websites, website owners.
Yeah, plus I don't think they thought all 84,000 were engaged in child porn. It was basically a technological glitch. They thought one of them was.
Yeah.
And the collateral damage was the other 83,999 or whatever.
Yeah, it was by taking off what they saw as the top level.
Right.
They didn't realize that there were 83,999 other websites that used that.
Because nobody had a chance to argue against this process.
Right.
Which, had they brought it before a judge and had a warrant and all the regular things that the Patriot Act completely circumvents, maybe, I'm not saying this was done under the Patriot Act, but, you know, I just like to put a dig on the Patriot Act whenever I can. The point is, like, it needed to go before a judge. And in addition to that, I mean, having it set up such that they didn't put up this stupid badge and warning, like, what gave them that right? Like, yeah, maybe the government has the right to haul you away in handcuffs when they suspect you of a crime, but they sure as hell don't have the right to, like, put a big sign on your house that says, hey, he's a child pornographer. Like, that's...
But they do have the right for sex offenders to make you go to all your neighbors and say, hey, I did this.
After that's conviction.
Conviction. That's conviction. This, we're talking about apprehension and, like, you know, putting you in police custody. They don't have that right. So what gave them the right to put that up on the... I think they've opened...
Well, and really, this is like, you know, somebody in Johnstown was a child pornographer, so everybody in Cambria County gets branded.
Yeah, very similar.
Yeah, with this badge.
And I think you brought up the point earlier, Ryan. Can you imagine business owners who got shut down because of this who now have to explain to their clients, whoa, I did not do anything with child pornography. This was a mistake.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, even myself included, you know, just with the smell of, you know, having something done wrong on someone else, you just will, like, avoid them. It's just like, I don't even want to deal with you because it's just not worth risking my professional career or whatever, you know? So I think that I don't know how they make this better, but this is an example of why they shouldn't do this crap at all. It should not be allowed. It should not be allowed at all.
And I don't think they can make it better. I mean, the damage is done. What are you going to do? You know?
Yeah. They didn't even admit fault.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Stupid government. So our last story before we get into some different audio-visual type stories, do you guys think this is the start of the second dot-com bubble?
Actually, yeah.
That's what a lot of people have been saying.
I read this article and I thought, wow, I'm like, this is so reminiscent of so many things.
Yeah, I didn't read the article, but I'll comment anyway.
Well, let me read a couple things before you comment. So they have a bulleted
that spoils
list.
It.
Okay, go ahead.
No, I mean, Apple's what, the first or second largest in market cap?
Second.
Facebook is what, 50 billion in valuation, 60 billion in valuation, something like that. Yeah, I don't see these as being realistic valuations, but go ahead and read your excerpts.
Well, that was pretty much, you know, points 1-2, you know, the arrival of a quote unquote new thing that cannot be valued in the old way. Dumb money companies start paying over the odds for new thing acquisitions. Or, you know, companies that just don't do things, like Facebook. You know, they don't really have a tangible product. They're kind of, you know, there's a lot of companies like Facebook. So a couple of the other points, there's a flurry of new investment funds catering for startups. Companies start getting funded off the slide deck without actually having a product. So they just have a PowerPoint and, oh, here's $3 million. Go make a company.
Wow, I made a PowerPoint the other day. I did not get $300 million for it.
Well, you could have.
Apparently.
MBAs leave banks to start up their own firms. Yeah, I mean, all of these points, this is crazy.
Yeah, the article gives a pretty good rundown of things that have happened in the last few years to totally signal the, you know, I mean, they obviously, the article sets up a 10-point list of what means, oh, we're on the dot-com bubble. And then they provide facts to support it.
Right.
It's not that this list of 10 things is a definitive definitive like recipe for a dot-com bubble. They've obviously, they made this up. I mean, it has, I think it's somewhat valid.
Oh, I definitely agree.
But I mean, what scares me the most, I mean, well, just going back to your point about Apple, Matt, are you saying when you gave Apple and Facebook as an example, was your example such that you don't think Apple has that valuation, or that Facebook in comparison to Apple doesn't have?
No, I think they're both overvalued.
And I would agree with that. I mean, I think Apple is a great company. They've appealed to a lot of people. They make great products. But I'm sorry, they're not worth more than an energy company.
More than ExxonMobil?
Yeah.
Yeah. More than Berkshire Hathaway?
There's no way. I mean, and I know they're coming. They seem to make a profit on, you know, they report a profit on their, but, you know, on their, pay a dividend. But I don't see it. I just
Well, all of their margin comes from having good ideas, right? You make a great phone, you make a great MP3 player, you make a great app store, which is all well and good, but how do you know somebody's not going to come along with an idea that's just good at some other company? There's no entrenchment there that prevents competition from eroding the huge margins they have.
And in some ways, this may be an argument for the fact that Apple should be able to patent the things that they have invented. And you know, there's a lot of discussion about, you know, should their ideas be patentable? Should their software be patentable? Like, you know, this is a big problem all over the tech industry. But, you know, and I think that not only could somebody come up with an idea that's as good, they could come up with something that's totally not even in the same league. Like, it's a different thing that's just, who cares about computers anymore? I'm going to go do this. You know, like, there just could be something totally different that completely undervalue or devalues what they have.
Yeah, and one interesting point, Mark Cuban, so he's the owner of a lot of things, you know, basketball teams, whatever, but he made most of his fortune in the first dot-com boom before that bubble burst, and now he is even calling this bubble a pyramid scheme.
Yeah. Oh, there's.
So he even sees the trouble with this.
I mean, and Mark Cuban should know because broadcast.com was a bunch of crap. I mean, he got paid like $5 billion for this idea that basically just rebroadcast radio stations online. I mean,
that was a good idea.
It was a great
idea. I love radio stations.
It was a great idea, but then they found out, oh, yeah, it's illegal. You can't do that. You know, like there's problems with it copyright wise. And
somebody was doing that with TV stations too. They were rebroadcasting like, you know, LA and New York broadcast traffic.
Yeah,
over the internet.
I mean, there's value in it, and I don't know why none of the companies that own the media have been able to make money from it. But I think there's definitely a huge overvaluation of a lot of these technologies. They're producing things that, you know, really just have no intrinsic value.
Yeah, that's why all of my retirement savings I've moved into a nice safe asset like tulip bulbs.
Tulip bulbs
never go down.
Never. They've never gone down ever, not even in history have they ever gone down.
I think I need to go redo my retirement portfolio.
I recommend the red and yellow stripy ones.
Ooh. Yeah. That's what I asked for, the red and yellow stripy ones. So do either of you guys have PlayStations?
Negative.
No.
Wow. I was hoping at least one of you did. So do either of you guys play video games? Whether through Facebook or whether on an iPhone or a phone or anything.
Civ 5 was on discount this weekend on Steam. So,
ooh.
Yeah. It was a Civ 5 weekend.
Does Super Nintendo count?
Well, yeah. I mean, they're video games.
Angry
yeah.
Birds.
Angry. Yeah, those,
yeah,
are, those
yeah.
are video
my,
games.
My birds are really pissed off, actually.
You haven't played for a while.
Yeah.
I do have Angry Birds. I bought Angry Birds on the Intel App Up Center. And I have to say, Angry Birds is hands down the best value in games you'll ever get. There's no better value.
I paid 99 cents on my iPod Touch.
Yeah, I think mine was
I've played like, you know, 20 hours or something.
Yeah. I think mine's $1.99. I mean, I paid like, you know, $60 for Doom 3, I don't know how many years ago. That disc like has sat in my you know, whatever cupboard for since the day I bought it. I installed it on a machine, I built a machine around it.
Yeah, around Christmas, I went to the mall, and there was this kiosk that had ceramic figurines, and they had green pigs in the middle of the mall, and I just wanted to grab a stuffed bird and throw it at that green pig.
Nice. So what if you could play your games, you know, PlayStation games, so these awesome games that everybody plays on their PlayStation, and also be able to call people at the same time, all on one device? Would you buy it?
No.
No.
No, because at least from my point of view, I can do that on my iPhone. You can call people via Skype on an iPod Touch, you know, whatever. Do you guys see a place for this PlayStation phone?
I mean, I think the gaming, hardware gaming input is compelling because they give a couple examples like in a driving game, and I've used this on the iPad where you push the iPad forward and the car goes faster.
Okay, well, that's stupid.
Yeah.
I don't like stupid accelerometer motions.
Yeah. Well, I mean, accelerometer for turning is great, but for brake and gas,
yeah,
it just doesn't make a lot of sense. You know, I don't like it.
But I play a Family Guy game I have on my iPhone, and, you know, the controls are just like a regular controller, except, you know, they're on screen. So I have, you know, arrows on my left thumb and buttons on my right thumb. And I thought it would suck because it's on-screen buttons, but it's not bad. It's not bad enough that would make me want to go buy a phone like this PlayStation phone that has real buttons.
Well, the problem with buttons on the screen is that it takes away from the game. That's what I don't like about buttons on the screen.
I don't like the lack of tactile feedback.
Well, tactile feedback's a big one for me, too. I agree. I mean, but, like, I guess you just have to totally throw tactile feedback out of the window if you're even going to talk about touch screens.
Yeah, that'll change. Yeah. When you get the haptic, you know.
Haptic helps. Yeah. It helps.
Oh.
Maybe if they got, like, pinpoint haptic where they could, like, do just the part where your finger touches instead of your whole hand vibrating.
But, you know, I got an iPod Touch for Christmas, like I mentioned last time I was on the show. And before I got it, I envisioned myself playing a lot of games on it when I was bored and sitting around somewhere. And what I found is that I don't. I play Angry Birds. I like my Angry Birds and, you know, kill the pigs, all that good stuff. But really, most of the time when I'm bored, I'm, you know, doing web browser type things. I'm going through my RSS feeds, or I'm going through the New York Times or The Economist or something like that. I'm reading far more often than I'm actually playing games. So my finding is that I don't care that much about playing games on a small device.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how this takes over, like, the Nintendo DS market and all of those other typical, I guess you could say, handheld consoles that don't have a phone built in. But, yeah, personally, I don't see this lasting long. This might be like the Atari, what was it? It's not the Jaguar, but...
Lynx?
Atari Lynx, yeah. Yeah, this is going to be like the Atari Lynx. It was
The Sega Dreamcast.
Well, that was a big console, right?
It was the Lynx, a small one.
The Lynx was a handheld, yeah.
Yeah, it was like a two-hand thing.
I got you.
Yeah. It was like, what was it, the first 64-bit handheld something, whatever. But
ooh, 64-bit.
I know,
was that
right?
The one where they like added the bits up where it was like a 32-bit processor with like 16-bit graphics and then like 16-bit audio, like, oh, 32 bits.
Nice.
There was one like that, I swear. I don't know if it was that one.
I think it was the same kind of platform as their Amiga competition, which was, well, like the TT or something like that.
I have no idea.
I was an 8-bit Atari guy. I never got into the 16 or 32 or, you know, 48.5, whatever
it was. And this is why Atari is in the axis of evil, because they use math, and math is very much a part of the axis of evil. Sorry, that was an old George Bush SNL comment I had to fit in there. So let's move it right along. Ryan, I believe you have the next article.
Yeah, so I saw an article on Wired, which turned out to be actually just like a repost of something from Ars Technica. They talk about an ongoing battle behind the scenes of the net neutrality deal and everything else that's going on, the NBC Universal Comcast merger. And basically this is like the survival of products like Google TV, Internet TV, you know, IPTV, whatever you want to call it. And the FCC is, you know, has proposed a sort of a successor to the whole cable card system, and it's called Allvid. I don't even think there's anything like actually like if it's come to fruition yet regarding.
Oh no,
Allvid.
It's just like in name only right
now.
Yeah,
it's like a spec basically, or a white paper.
Isn't it like a group?
Yeah, it might be a group.
Yeah.
But basically, you know, Google's got their full weight behind this. They would like to see this happen. And what Allvid is it basically would be this thing that you plug into your router that connects to your cable company and or whatever your, you know, whatever your IP source is, and then the rest of your network can get, you know, video content from it. Because everyone knows how much of a failure cable card was. While it seemingly should have worked and really just needed to be augmented with some bidirectional communication, it failed, mainly because the cable companies, you know, pushed it into failure. Which I can't blame them. They wanted to make money, you know, and it was.
Yeah, cable cards should have worked.
Yeah.
Except that you couldn't do things like get pay-per-view or on-demand or all of the other services you can get from a cable box.
Right. And I just thought this article was interesting. It talks about the, you know, basically what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, there's challenges in delivering internet video. And, you know, making sure people get paid for their content and obviously the cable companies own the pipe into our houses, so overcoming them is a big challenge.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but this seems to be a replacement to what cable car was supposed to do, right? allow you to have all of your own things, and you have this one piece of hardware that brings them all together or lets you still have your own things. Is that kind of what this Allvid spec is doing?
Well, I think you could think of it as a cable box that like has an Ethernet port with an open standard. And, you know, having it on the network allows anything on the network to access the video that the cable box serves up.
Okay, I can see that. I don't know if I would want another box, you know?
Well,
I have enough boxes.
I don't think the video is delivered in a way that everyone can use it over the internet, but in this way at least, you know, anything that's Ethernet connected could connect to this box. I think that's part of the idea.
So it seems like it's more focused toward people who have multiple input sources: DVD, satellite, internet streaming shows, right? I mean, that seems to be what this Allvid.
I mean, that's probably a good use case.
Yeah, Matt, do you watch any? Do you have this problem where you have so many sources of input and you have trouble getting them all into one place?
No, we only have one TV. We have DirecTV satellite for a TV, and DirecTV is kind of nice because it has a Windows application where I can watch anything that's on my DirecTV DVR over my Ethernet network on my computer. So that pretty much takes care of everything. You know, mostly we watch TV. If my wife's watching TV, then I can call up a DVR show on my computer, and that's good enough for me.
So there's no like a podcast, video podcast, streaming internet video that you wish you could have on your TV, but it's pretty difficult now?
Yeah, once again, I'm on satellite internet.
So. I don't even know why I brought that up. I totally forget about the satellite internet thing.
Yeah, so the only high bandwidth content we get is through DirecTV, and they're dispersing that, you know, to the computer pretty well.
Yeah, I'm very interested to see how this turns out, because just from this article, I'm not sure that I want it. I'm not sure I have a need for it personally, but whenever this actually comes out and they have products with it, this might be something I rush out to buy like right now.
Yeah, I found another article on Ars Technica about it. This was from about 10 months ago. They describe it as, under the proposal, cable, satellite, or telco video providers would send their signals to a small adapter on the customer's premises that would present a standard interface to all other consumer devices. So my guess is that this thing would have some standard that then everything else can talk to.
Yeah, it's a nice idea architecturally.
Yeah, because the biggest problem that I've seen with the nice thing about cable is that there's a lot of devices out there that can at least interface with cable. Like, yeah, there's some challenges now with like encrypted QAM channels and everything else, but even overcoming those is becoming less and less of a problem as we've moved on. And hopefully, I mean, they're talking about getting rid of cable card, but it's just recently now that Windows 7 supports encrypted QAM QAM decryptors, legal ones that, you know, you buy from somebody and you put a cable card and they just work. But anyways, you know, I think something like this would allow, would bring sort of a commonality between all the interfaces, because with satellite TV, there's no option. You know, there's not really any commercially available, at least the affordable satellite tuners for PCs, except maybe in Europe, I think.
Yeah, there's nothing here.
Yeah, so.
I'm interested to see how this plays out. So let's move right along. Seems that a company called Gemalto, I believe that's how you say the name, maybe it's Gemalto, I don't know, they're Dutch, but they appear to be putting Facebook on a SIM card for mobile phones. Now, one thing that I was very disappointed is I couldn't find out any information on how this works. So let me tell you just what the article says. The app uses Class 2 SMS to ensure that it works with every handset. So you're accessing Facebook via SMS messages. You don't need a data plan, so any handset can do it. The code is on a SIM card, so you have to put a new SIM card in your phone to use this. I have a lot of questions about this, because that's pretty much all the article says. You know, what I want to say is, okay, if you have to replace your SIM card with this Facebook SIM card, how do you make phone calls now? You can only use Facebook. And B, how do you use Facebook via SMS message? Do you like send a text that says, give me status updates, and it sends you 10 SMSs of your top, you know, 10 most recent friend status updates? Like, do you guys see any way that this is going to be useful for people?
I mean, my guess is that they're going to, you know, integrate this into like the SIMs provided by AT&T and T-Mobile, and that's how they'll do it. I think it's too little too late. And in that, you know, while the Microsoft Kin was like a complete failure, you know, but I think that day of like bringing those features to a lower priced handset are not far away. I mean, you can get the iPhone 3GS from Apple or from AT&T now for $49. They've been advertising it. And yeah, the data plans have to come down in price, but it's a matter of time. I mean, this is just, it's to me, this is like Blu-ray. It's just, it's too little too late.
So what's wrong with Blu-ray?
Well, I mean, HD video is distribution is going to overtake Blu-ray probably in a couple years.
Can I have broadband internet, please?
Except for Matt.
So, wait. So, judging by your internet access, do you still watch Betamaxes, VHSs?
No, I have a Blu-ray. I love my Blu-ray.
All right.
And DirecTV is pretty good.
I will say that, you know, I have Dish Network, and their HD content is pretty good. I just watched Over the Hedge. It was on a couple days ago. And some of the action scenes, the blockiest pictures I have ever seen.
Yeah, what always gets me is like concert footage where you have strobe lights and confetti and stuff like that.
You can't see anything.
Yeah, that's ridiculous on any kind of broadcast medium. Blu-ray is great. I love my Blu-ray. DirecTV is decent.
So what do you think about this, the Facebook on a SIM?
I just read something. I should have read it more closely. Something about it being a more common practice in other countries to use multiple SIM cards with one phone for separating like your business telephone from your personal telephone. And I guess you switch them out habitually.
That's interesting. I never would have thought people did that.
Yeah, I just saw something about that. I didn't read it that closely because it was sort of a European, Middle Eastern-centric article. I didn't look at it that closely, but maybe this Facebook approach fits in with that. It doesn't sound that appealing to me, but I guess it's a way of life for some people.
Yeah, that's true. I just don't see how you can access Facebook via SMS message. You know, of course, you know, most of us who have Facebook and use it on our phones, we know that we can send updates via SMS. That's great. But how do you interact with Facebook? How do you see your newsfeed? How do you read other people's posts via text message?
Yeah, maybe they come to you periodically. I mean, you may not get the backlog of messages as soon as you pop in the new SIM card, but in real time, as people make new updates, maybe you receive those by SMS.
I bet the phone companies charging their extraordinary, you know, dollar amounts for texting plans will be very happy about this.
But that must not be the case, or else this wouldn't be a viable model, right? The people producing the SIM cards must have some good deal on the SMS messages.
They're going to have to. Because, I mean, the whole point of this was to get around a data plan. But, yeah, they would also have to get around the texting plan to be able to do this.
Right.
It's ridiculous. So have any of you ever had the trouble of, say you want to get your work email on your phone, and your company says no because they can't control your phone, or they tell you they have to be able to control your phone to be able to put your work email on it. Have any of you run into that before?
No, I'm very happy not to receive my work email on my phone.
That's kind of how I am.
Actually, I volunteered. Well, you know, I investigated it on my end of like what it would take for that to happen. And I wasn't even interested in the subsidies that the company offers. I just basically wanted to be able to get email on my phone so that I could get to it when necessary and email others in the company when necessary, when disconnected. You know, like at meetings, offsite, that sort of thing. And I was disenchanted with the fact that they would need to take full control of the phone, basically.
Yeah, that's basically an option that most people don't realize within Microsoft Exchange Server, that once you connect a mobile device to Exchange Server, Exchange has that built-in remote kill functionality that is just there. So if you connect your phone to your company's Exchange Server to get your email, they can wipe your phone right now. Like, that's just there.
I don't know that it's so much a feature of Microsoft Exchange. They can definitely remote wipe.
It's ActiveSync is what it uses, and that's where the feature resides.
Right, but the ActiveSync can't touch certain other parts of the phone. The problem is that, like, well, specifically with BlackBerry, is that, you know, in order for you to get that feature, you have to be connected to a BlackBerry Enterprise server, and that is what gives them the ability. It's the BlackBerry Enterprise server.
In the case of BlackBerry's, right?
Yeah.
In the case of my iPhone, we don't have that middle ground server, so it's literally the ActiveSync code on my phone and on the Exchange server that can just wipe my phone.
Yeah, that doesn't worry me too much. I mean, on my iPod Touch, I have it set up to wipe after 10 incorrect pins. It's the same idea. So what happens then? Well, I go back to my last backup, which was, you know, 3 hours ago. Fine.
So yeah. Only slightly annoying to us, but wouldn't it be nice if we could just have another operating system running on our phone at the same time that our company controlled? So that's what VMware is setting out to do with Android, this article from Engadget. VMware can now run, at least in their demos, it's not public yet, on Android phones, so that your company can give you a fully provisioned phone OS virtual on your phone. They can do whatever they want with it. They can wipe it if they need to, whatever, does not affect your phone. So you basically have two full operating systems running on your phone at the same time. And they claim no lag. It looks like a real OS. It doesn't affect your base OS. Would you guys allow for this if you had Android phones?
I definitely would consider this. And I also think that there have, you know, to further extend that is that I would consider this using this technology on a personally owned laptop rather than having a company provide me with some resource that, you know, may or may not be up to snuff, in my opinion. If, you know, if I was allowed to use something that I felt would get my job done, such as an Apple versus a PC, that I could run VMware and then, you know, run their environment on that machine. And, you know, so I think it applies in the phone world and the desktop world, and I totally would embrace it.
That's interesting. I never thought about using it on a computer, you know, instead of a phone.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I'm fine with letting them remotely wipe it. I think even for a personal phone, if the thing's lost, I want the thing to be wiped for my personal data or professional data. I'm not that worried about my employer wiping my phone maliciously or anything like that. That's not...
It's probably not going to be malicious. It might be an accident.
Yeah, I'm still not really worried about it. I guess it could happen, but it's not going to keep me up at night. But yeah, I don't see any downside to it.
Very interesting. I'm interested to see exactly how this VMware on Android works, because right now, you know, it's just demos. It's not real. I want to see a couple of my friends at work have Android phones, and I want to see them running this. I really want to see this in action. But while we're talking about Android, we had an article last week or 2 weeks ago whenever Google said, you know, our tablet OS and our phone OS, they're separate things. They will never be the same. Well, now we have an article from Google where Eric Schmidt says, oh, yeah, they're merging. I personally think this is ridiculous, but do you guys see any point to merging a tablet OS with a phone OS and keeping it all as one OS? Do you see any benefit to that over, you know, pretty much what Apple was doing with keeping the iOS version of for the iPad separate from the iPhone?
Well, last time I was here, we were critical of the Android approach because the claim was that you couldn't develop applications that would work on both the tablet and the phone versions, whereas the Apple approach was seen as more unified. So has this reversed course since 2 weeks ago, or am I missing something?
No. I'm just pointing out Google's within a week total 180 that they're like, nope, we will never, you know, these will be separate things. And they're like, oh yeah, totally together. I just find that weird. I know I introduced it as the exact opposite of what we talked about.
Well, I don't think merging them is a great idea. I mean, it's sad to see that if they would fork and then there'd be features that wouldn't be shared across. That's obviously hard to, you know, stomach if you like some of the features on Gingerbread and they're not available on Honeycomb or Ice Cream Sandwich, whatever they call it. But the thing that you know, that I just always sticks in my head when it comes to designing interfaces is what Bill Gates talked about it, like All Things D, probably 3 or 4 years ago. And I think he was really a visionary on this because, you know, tablets and phones really didn't exist. Smartphones, other than like Windows Mobile and BlackBerry, didn't exist at the time. And he basically said, you know, I see three screen sizes: handheld, you know, in the palm of your hand, the small screen and the large screen. And no one's designing for this. Like, you know, you have Apple on one hand, you know, trying to shoehorn iOS into the iPad size device that, like, is basically the same device, same size device as their, like, laptop, you know, essentially. And they don't think about the big screen at all. And Microsoft has, like, lost their way on the big screen with, you know, media center. It's just they can't advertise it. They can't sell it. I don't know why. I think, you know, the big screen at home thing is what people really want. They buy laptops because they're portable and they're that's what they sell in stores. But I think what most people want is a 10-foot interface in their homes.
They want the lean back experience.
Yeah, I mean, I love sitting back and just like floking around on a remote, you know, and in it.
What was that word?
Flicking. it was somewhere between floating and flicking.
Oh.
But you know, it just seems like no one has like got this concept down yet. No one has got it.
Yeah, and it's funny because how long ago did Bill Gates say that?
Yeah, this was like 2006 or 2007.
Yeah,
it was right before the iPhone came out, I think. So I mean this is just kind of another example of like I know there's a lot of people out there, they're like all about specs and they want an HTML5 compliant browser on their phone, but get an HTML5 compliant browser and then go to some website that has like that's meant for a 800 by 600 screen or larger, and the website is useless. I mean, it's just useless on the phone. You need a different interface, and I wish people would just accept that. They're different. It's like, you know, it's like a mini fridge and a big fridge. It's like, you know, there's the controls are bigger on, or maybe that's a bad example, but you know, you have big things and small things, and the controls are different sizes on them, and they need to be different sizes because they're different sizes.
Now, I'll agree with you there in terms of the mobile websites, because even though, you know, Safari on the iPhone, it gives you the regular web experience you would get on a desktop or laptop, I still find it very difficult on some sites to have to, you know, pull apart Zoom and pitch yeah. Zoom three times to see what I want to see, click on something, zoom back out to get, you know, the full view of the page, zoom in somewhere else. That's difficult.
It just yeah, go ahead, sorry.
Even with my iPod Touch, if I go to Panera or Sheets or somewhere where it's like a enter your email address and click this button to log into the Wi-Fi, those are designed for browsers.
Yeah.
And I have to zoom in to hit the login button, even though it's a one-click interface.
Yeah. So, So Ryan, you say that bringing these back together is not a good idea. You think they should be separate because there are different features that need to be on different devices.
Yeah. I mean, I just think, I do think that they're different devices. I think that, you know, coding, like if there's features that need to be like shared across code bases, that's fine. But the UI, I just think needs to be different. I mean, tablets and touch phones are maybe similar enough, maybe. But, you know, these aren't the end-all interfaces of computers. Yeah, they're cool, and they're a lot different than keyboard and mouse, but it's not the end-all. It's not. We're not going to... In 20 years, we will not be using touch interfaces. I can tell. Well, I mean, it won't be the primary interface.
We'll be using thinking.
Yeah, I mean, there's going to be other interfaces, and you just need to have that other interface.
Watson
you know?
Will tell us what to do.
Yes, I hope so.
That would be so nice.
Yeah, I mean, last time we discussed this, the thinking was that on Android, you would have to develop two completely different applications to run on the phone and the tablet. And we contrasted that to iOS, where you could develop one application that runs on the iPhone and the iPad. And even in that case, I think you can present a slightly different interface, right? So something that might be one pane on the iPhone turns into two panes on the iPad, something like that.
Right. We mentioned, you know, doing different checks in code to see what's there. And...
Yeah. So if this unification means that you can write one application that runs on both, even if you present a different interface, that's probably a good thing. But, yeah, you don't just want your tablet to be a two or three times as big version as your phone interface either.
Right. I mean, I always go back to this one example with the CNN Sports Illustrated website, CNNSI.com. You go there on a phone, and if it detects that it's your mobile browser and not a full screen browser, it's like the perfect interface. It's so easy to find what you want. And anytime you're on your phone and you go to CNNSI.com, there's one thing you want: scores for the game. Mm-hmm. and it makes it really simple to find those scores, current and the past few days, and the games that are coming up in the next few days. It's the best. CNN, SI, if you are listening, do not change your website. It's perfect the way it is.
And give us a call. We want to personally thank you.
Yes, exactly. That'd be awesome.
So let's keep going with Android. I believe, Ryan, you have an article to talk about some app stores.
Yes, I do. Oh, so a study recently published, this came out on Security Week, that the App Store for the Android market is growing at 3 times the rate of the Apple App Store. It's interesting because, you know, the Apple App Store saw such enormous growth in its infancy.
Everything shows enormous growth in its infancy.
Yeah.
That's why, you know, percentage growth rates aren't that meaningful.
They might. I think the study does show that adjusted for time, the Android App Store is growing faster than the Apple Store ever did, which is impressive. And it just shows that there's a possibility that it may overtake it at some point. Not that I think that 1,000 fart apps are what really everyone needs anyways.
Well, that's what I was just going to say. My initial reaction to this article was, duh. There's no approval process. Anybody can upload 20 million apps that they wrote in their basement today if they wanted to.
Okay, right. So without having read the article, because that is my practice, what I would be interested in seeing is dollars of apps sold per phone unit sold. Do we have figures on that?
I would love to see that too, because that's a good point. They say a lot of the apps, number one, not all the apps on the App Store, the Apple App Store, are free. In addition, a lot of the apps, the downloads, you know, they have 1 billion downloads. Also, the vast majority are free apps.
Yeah, most people, at least in the Apple App Store, use, you know, the freemium model.
Yeah.
So.
Or like paid through advertising.
Right. Right.
So I mean, I'm sure the same thing's true of Android, but you know, only time will tell whether these app stores are providing, you know, just a place for everybody to put their crap up there, or if they're really providing value to a customer. And those types of numbers would be great.
They would be great. I doubt we'll ever see them. You know, do you see Google putting out those numbers or Apple putting out those numbers? Especially the ones, Matt, that you brought up in terms of, you know, prices and the amount that they sold. And I don't know that those have come out.
I haven't read the annual reports.
That's true. You know, we should look at the annual report and see what information is in there.
We should do some journalism.
Let's actually do some journalism. Who would have thought? So while we're talking about app stores, Microsoft, with their app store or their marketplace, whatever they call it, for Windows Phone, is doing something interesting. I don't know that any other app store does this, but Microsoft is. They are not allowing applications in if they have open source code, specifically anything GPL licensed.
Yeah, it's a GPL thing, not an open source thing.
Right.
And I think the issue comes down to the requirement of the GPL that a redistributor provide access to the source code. And I think Microsoft would put itself in the position of having to provide the source code for anything that was provided. And I think they just don't care to do that. They want to send you a signed app for your phone and nothing else, and they don't want that responsibility, which they would legally incur with providing GPL apps. So I don't see this as a huge deal. I mean, it's kind of annoying, but I don't think this is some philosophical stand against open source. I think it's that they don't want to expose themselves to this requirement.
Well, here's why I think that it's not that special. A, it's only GPL v3. And actually, it's only because of the extending clause that's in GPL v3 that you know, you have to, the way it interacts with commercial software, basically.
I thought it was v2 also.
No, I think it's just v3. Here's the other interesting point. Apple bans all GPL software. No GPL.
VLC?
Huh? Yeah.
The VLC thing.
Yeah.
I mean, that
Apple
came up
allows there. No GPL software on its App Store. So Microsoft is not only less lenient than, or more lenient than Apple in this case, I think they've put a stand up to the GPL v3, which, as has most of the industry, the GPL v3 is not widely accepted yet. I think most people draw a lot of problems with it. And while I like a lot of what Stallman has to say on free software, I think he's basically off his rocker on this now. You know,
so what do you guys think? Let's talk a little bit more general about this. What do you think in terms of, you know, barrier to entry for developers? A lot of developers that write, you know, software on a computer itself, they can make applications that are useful for them and their friends or for other people, in part because there is so much open source, possibly GPL v3 code out there they can plug and play into their software. Does this make it harder for developers now to make Windows applications or to make iOS applications because now they have to write everything themselves, which not everybody can do?
Or use license libraries.
If they exist for what they want to do.
Yeah,
right.
But I mean, I'm a
BSD
guy.
Or use GPL v2 libraries. I mean, the whole thing is that's the point. Like, you just use a slightly less restrictive open source license. This article is completely, I think it's completely biased. It basically is trying to paint Microsoft into a corner and saying that they're the big bad guy when it comes to open source software, when they've probably contributed just as much as any other company to open source in the last, you know, several years, where finally, you know, corporate America has embraced open source software. I don't know, maybe they haven't, but the point is that they have a better ground to stand on than anyone else does in this issue, except for maybe Android.
I'm definitely agreeing with you. The article is biased.
Yeah.
But I did put it in there because I wanted to talk about that. You know, just the barrier to entry for some people. You know, who knows? Maybe
it's not. That's what I'm saying. It's not a barrier to entry. Just find a library that's GPL v2 or some other open source license. There's no
barrier.
But
that's my point. If you can. Depending on what you're doing,
GPL
maybe there isn't.
GPL v3 has not even been that well. It's
like, it's been out for a long time.
Since like 07 it was finalized in. It doesn't mean that it's widely accepted. Most stuff is not licensed through GPL v3.
What open source tools can I use to develop iOS applications outside of an Apple platform?
Oh, you can't use it to develop. But I'm saying,
so what are we talking about here?
If you wanted to include functionality in your program that you didn't write from the ground up yourself.
Okay, so
an open source library that grabs stuff from the camera, for instance.
Something like that, yeah.
You know, what Kevin's saying is there's a barrier because you'd have to like write that yourself, and I'm saying no, you just go find a library that's written in GPL v3 or v2 BSD or Apache or something
right,
else.
Something completely free.
Yeah. I mean, those licenses are more widely accepted, and people are starting to abandon the GPL view because Stallman has been so, like, you know, he's been so, I don't know what the word is, just, you know, he's being an asshole about it. He's obvious. The GPL v3, the whole point is to completely, like, basically cut out commercial use of the software at all.
Yeah, that's always been his goal. I mean, back in the, you know, mid-90s, Windows used the BSD IP stack mm-hmm. in Windows. And people were like, oh my God, they're stealing the BSD IP stack. My philosophy has always been, okay, Windows has a decent IP stack. Great. We're all better off for it.
Right.
Yeah, that's what I don't get. I mean, he has no problem with Red Hat selling software. You know, I love the work he's done, but, you know, a lot of the work he's done is on the backs of all the developers anyways. I mean, he was the one that couldn't successfully write a kernel for Linux, and it fell on Linus. I mean, that's what happens.
Very true.
So,
Ryan, I believe you have the next article talking about some phones.
So,
I always catch you off guard.
Yeah, you do. I don't always follow the script, so I'm like reading the articles. Verizon released Apple released their version of the iPhone that runs on Verizon, and it broke all kinds of records, but according to Apple Insider, it fell below expectations. They expected it to be a bigger success than it even was. They stated that it sold something like 550,000 units in the first 2 hours, which is pretty impressive. What do you think? I mean, do you think it was a success? Do you know anyone that's bought an iPhone on Verizon?
I do not. On launch day, Twit had live coverage. They had people out on the street at the Apple stores in California, because they figure, you know, in those cities, that's where the rush would be, you know, there and New York City. So they had people out, you know, videotaping, and there were no lines. Like, people could just walk in and get their phones and walk back out. There was no rush. Nobody seemed to care. If there was a line, it was maybe 10 people long.
Is that because Verizon did the launch better? I mean, they broke all sales records for the iPhone 4. Like every sales record so far they broke.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. I think part of it's that. I think the other part is if you are an iPhone fanboy and phone trumps platform, you have an iPhone 4 already and you've been using AT&T for 4 years now or whatever and you can live with it.
Yeah.
On Verizon, I think the existing Verizon customer base has been okay with other phones, whether dumb phones or Android phones or whatever. And I think a lot of people are thinking of switching to the iPhone the next time they buy a phone, but they don't have the sense of urgency that you've always seen with the iPhone crowd when Apple announces a new iPhone and everybody needs to get the new generation of iPhone the day that it's launched because that's a new phone with new capabilities. And
yeah, no new capability. In fact, some ways this has less capability.
Right.
It does have less.
Right. So if you already have an iPhone 4 on AT&T, I don't see what the sense of urgency would be. If you've lived with AT&T, you can probably continue to live with AT&T until your contract runs out or whatever.
And I think that's the big thing of why they didn't see bigger numbers is because that iPhone fanboy group, they still have a year left in their contract.
Right.
They're not about to pay $300 to go get a Verizon version just so they can have two less drop calls.
Right. So I think you'll see a migration, to some degree, a migration from AT&T to Verizon, but also existing Verizon customers picking up the iPhone. But I think it'll be a more gradual process than this everybody shows up at day one enthusiasm that you see with the, you know, the true-blooded iPhone crowd.
Right. I think you'll see numbers go up, you know, June or July when the iPhone 5 comes out. I think that's when people who are already on Verizon will say, okay, new phone, new features, now I'll get it.
Exactly. I mean, that's the way I think. I think that's the way other people think, that it's not something that you need to line up for on day one.
Yeah. I'll be in line to get the iPhone 5 when it comes out, of course. I have to get the new one.
Fanboy.
Yeah, but you do that no matter what carrier, right?
Yeah, I don't care.
So you're part of that group that when a new generation of iPhone comes out, you're there on day one.
Right.
I think that's different from the new carrier approach because there's no new functionality. You know, it's not going to be fancier or anything like that.
Right.
Other than you get 3G in like 90% more of the area of the United States.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't have any trouble with AT&T.
Yeah, I mean, AT&T supposedly works around here pretty well, so.
Yeah, and there was an interesting article that I didn't put on here because I just wanted to throw it in now, that during, I forget where it was. I should have had the article up so I don't sound like an idiot like I always do, but a January 26th storm in some state, wherever it was, I forget. But apparently Verizon dropped a crap ton of 911 calls. You know, so much so that there was an article written about it. They were comparing, say, hey, AT&T is not so bad now, are they?
Huh.
And I just thought that was funny that, you know, that always seemed to be the biggest reason that people would migrate when this phone came out. No more dropped calls. But, you know, then that article came out seeing, you know, tens of thousands of dropped calls from Verizon customers to 911. And now it's like, oh.
I wonder how much of that onus is on Verizon, though, or if it's the local 911 system. Because the 911 system has to have some input into their phone network to even get the calls. And, you know, they can only handle so much. And maybe it's just a matter of like, oh, my call wouldn't go through. And I can't determine the difference between the fast busy signal and the slow busy signal to determine if it's a drop call or just a busy signal.
Yeah. There's also backhoe hits Verizon fiber and stuff
there
like
is.
That.
There is.
Yeah, there's always those
That's
stories.
Happened around here where everybody with Verizon loses service. And
yeah.
Yeah, the article.
That was the old excuse back in the college days. Hey, why are the computer labs down? Oh, some backhoe in Idaho pulled up some fiber.
Yeah.
Nice. So our last two articles of the day, Matt, if you don't mind, you seem to have a lot to say about this Apple subscription services.
Yeah, so the new Apple service or App Store policy is that if you want to sell content through an app sold in the App Store, you have to provide a mechanism in the app to do so, and it has to go through Apple's purchasing mechanism, and Apple gets a 30% cut of whatever purchases are made. And my general feeling about this is that 30% is a huge cut to content providers. If you're a magazine or a newspaper or something like that that's already struggling these days, you can't really afford to lose 30%. Rhapsody has already said, no, we're not going to do this. Readability, which has a model, actually, ironically similar to Apple's model. Readability, you pay a monthly fee if you want to use it, and they keep 30% and pass 70% on to the content providers. They're basically saying, well, there goes our cut if we have to give it to Apple, or we have to short the content providers. So I think you were saying content providers rebelling against this, and I can see both sides, but I think I fall on the content provider side. My thinking tends to be that I paid Apple for my device. The developers are developing specifically for that device, and so if they want to sell their product in the App Store, I can sort of see that they know Apple's going to get 30% going into it. On the other hand, the New York Times or The Economist or whatever didn't really bargain for this. They want to make some money on, you know, the reporters, the content, that kind of thing. And it seems like a pretty big cut to me on companies that are already struggling in a lot of ways. And I have trouble siding with Apple in this when Apple has such high margins and they're trying to make this money off of companies that are really struggling.
And here's one extra nail in the coffin is that what's also more important to companies other than money is information about their customers.
Yeah, of which I'm a little on Apple's side on that one, that aspect, but go on.
But of which Apple is not giving to the content providers. You know, they're allowing the customers to choose how much, if any, personal information gets shared with the New York Times or whoever they're subscribing to. And content providers are also in an uproar about this, too, that, hey, you know, normally we would get information about our demographic. We don't have that anymore. We don't know who to advertise to. We don't know anything.
Yeah, I'm pretty happy with giving the newspapers my money in exchange for their services. I'm less happy about giving them my information, my mailing address, and my stuff like that. In terms of gross demographic information, like our readership is this percent white, this percent incomes over $100,000, that kind of thing. I can see the utility of that, but I would imagine that they could extrapolate that from their subscription base in other sources pretty well, or through other mechanisms like surveys. So I side with the publishers a little more on the money side than the personal information side.
Ryan, do you have any opinion one way or another?
Well, you know, if you compare it to the old model, if you got a subscription to a newspaper, they would have information to or access to your personal information, and they would be keeping, you know, pretty much all of what their subscription fee is. In fact, like I thought back then that mainly the subscription fee was just to cover the costs of distribution and printing of the paper. But the actual content was paid through advertising.
Yeah, that's about right, I think.
So, you know, really, I think the content costs have gone down. So I don't know why I have to pay for this at all if I'm looking at advertising.
I think their advertising revenue has probably gone down in part because modern advertising methods like Google's ads and probably the iOS ads are a whole lot better at quantifying the effect of their advertising, and it's probably not as beneficial as was previously believed. So I don't think the content producers are making as much money from online ads as they did from print ads.
Right. But I mean, yeah, it's an interesting problem because media companies are basically in the position where they made their money through advertising, you know, and now they don't have that revenue stream anymore. So how do they capitalize on what they make, you know, what they sell? And Apple's in a position where, well, we're a place to sell your stuff, and we've developed the technology to read this on. I don't know. I think this is the problem. You know, it's really hard to look at the revenue models for all these things because the devices are paid for through, like, the fact that, oh, we know we're going to sell software for these things, kind of like the way video games are. You know, like, oh, video game sales pay for the console losses. And then you also have like subscription fees to your, or carrier fees to the, you know, the mobile platforms like Verizon and AT&T that kind of sort of subsidize the hardware. So it's very unclear as to how these companies make money. You know.
Yeah, I agree. It's all mixed up a great deal. But also on the other hand, You know, I have an iPod Touch. There's no carrier subsidy. Apple was selling me this product before they basically revised their policy. Even if it was there in print, they weren't enforcing it before. They knew they would make money from app sales, and I've spent, I don't know, probably $60 to $100 since December on apps. So they made that money off of me already, which they could have anticipated, but now they seem to want to add to that in a new way. And I'm not entirely in support of that. You know, when the newspaper or the magazine had to mail me a copy, I understood that the money I was paying them went to the, to cover the cost of production and mailing and so forth. But Apple getting 30% of that for basically no service whatsoever, aside from copying a few bits around.
Yeah.
That, you know, I can,
I mean, they have to pay for bandwidth, but bandwidth...
Bandwidth is fractions of a cent
on
the amount of content we're talking about. With the App Store, I can understand that Apple reviews the apps for certain guidelines, that there's certain quality controls and stuff. So I can understand some overhead in that. Plus, that's been factored into the their business model for a long time. This just seems more like a money grab to me.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if it's that maybe the hardware and the App Store model isn't making Apple quite as much revenue as they predicted. So that's why they are making this money grab. You know, like maybe they're finding that this model is. I mean, why else would they make a grab like this?
Because they can. Because they can try.
Well, I mean, they have the biggest user base.
Yeah, I mean, they financially they've been very successful. We've seen that in their earnings reports and so forth. Their margins are very high. They're beating up every other competitor. I think Apple's model is that they're going to try to get any money they can, and they think they're more essential to the content producers than the content producers are to them. And maybe that's true, and maybe Apple will win, but that doesn't mean I'm happy about it.
Or maybe Google will come in with their OnePass system, you know, to let the publishers set their own terms for access to content, and maybe all the content providers will move over to Google OnePass and stop putting stuff on Apple products. Who knows? You know, Google OnePass pretty much just came out, so I don't know of any content providers who are using it to distribute their content. But
yeah, I think the big battleground is going to be Kindle on iOS.
I use that. I just started using that.
Yeah. But I mean, that's behemoth against behemoth.
Right.
Each of which knows a great deal about pricing power.
Yeah.
Very, very true. Yeah, well, because didn't Apple try to... Well, I mean, Kindle is what they were initially going after with this whole, you know, you must use our payment system.
It was after Sony's ebooks with the implication that Kindle would be next in line.
Okay.
It may be waiting on Kindle to submit their next revision to the App Store, because it seems like all of these issues come up with when a developer submits a new app for approval. So it may be that the next time Amazon submits a Kindle app, it gets rejected by the
It would
app
be
store.
Interesting if Amazon held out and then Apple changed the API such that for the next phone that they would need to resubmit the app in order for it to work on the new iOS.
Ooh. But, you know, there's a side issue here, which is that Apple is willing to negotiate side agreements on an individual basis. They are not requiring Netflix to submit to this policy.
Did that actually go through, finalized?
I just read that in the last day or two. Yeah,
that's probably because they just feel sorry for Netflix because they're getting beat up by Comcast.
No, I think it's because Netflix is a selling feature for the iOS platforms, for the iPad and the iPhone. People want to watch their Netflix streaming on those devices. So, maybe Apple does the same thing with Amazon. Maybe they say the Kindle app is important enough that we'll cut you a deal. Maybe instead of 30%, it's 10% or 5% or whatever, and then nothing really gets resolved.
So screw over the little guy, but let the big guys through.
Exactly. Yes.
Nice.
Yeah.
Is this maybe an example or a small precursor to the net neutrality agreement or net neutrality discussion, where Apple's like misusing their power to like favor and not favor certain companies for their own benefit, you know, versus?
I think it bears a similarity. I don't know that it would be covered by the same regulation because it's not network traffic. But yeah, it's the same kind of argument.
Yeah.
Yeah, very true. So we'll see if any new rules, what are we going to call it? Content neutrality.
Well, I mean, we've talked about before about, you know, them owning a marketplace and maybe having to, you know, if you own a, if you open a marketplace, I guess the best example is the stock exchange. You have to follow certain rules if you run a stock exchange. You know, there's rules, and Apple has a marketplace, and there are rules for it to, if you like run a marketplace. You know, it's different. I don't think it's quite the same thing as like a brick and mortar store that just sells a lot of different gadgets inside the store. It's kind of like a market square where everybody, you can sell whatever you want and people buy whatever they want.
Yeah, I have trouble seeing them getting in trouble for it because they're basically applying the same rules to everyone. Even if they're exempting Netflix or something, they could construct that as a volume discount, right? They could still say, you know, below this threshold, you're paying 30%. Above this threshold, you're paying some smaller amount, and construct some consistent set of rules that still basically involves them grabbing a lot of money for content without doing anything that's inherently unfair in terms of treating some people better than others. Yeah. So I don't know that that's going to be a problem for them, unless the content producers decide to bail on them. And it's hard to see that.
All right. So that seems to be all we have for this show. Did either of you guys see anything that happened in the past week we didn't cover you wanted to talk about? No, I didn't see anything either.
Not really.
I tried to go through and, you know, make sure we were up to date to today. So I think we got that. And that's all we have for this version of the Slongcast. As usual, you can find me on Facebook and Twitter. My username is Slongcack. Ryan, where can people go to find you?
I'm on Facebook at @RyanLancey and also Twitter @RyanLancey.
And Matt, if people wanted to get in contact with you, where would they go?
On Twitter is Coneslayer, Coneslayer. And my blog is Scotch Tape and Duct Whiskey at ductwhiskey, ductwhisky.com.
All right. And if you want us to talk about an article for next week's show, bookmark it on Delicious as Slongcast025, and we will be sure to give our opinions on it. And that is everything for this week's edition of the Slongcast. Have a wonderful Tuesday evening.